Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. March 22nd, 2019 in Melbourne, Australia. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 4, Chapter 21, Instructions by Maharaj Prithu, Text 28 to 29. We have 28 on the board. Manorutana padasya Dhruvasyapi mahipate Priyavratasya rajarsher Angasyasmat pitu pitu. So there's one more verse here, 29, they're together, so I'll just read that one. Idrisham atanyesham ajasya cha bhavasya cha praladasya balescha pi krityam asti gadabhrita. Word for word. Manaho.
Manaho.
Of Manu Swayambhuva Manu. Utanapasya. I'm sorry. Utanapadasya.
Utanapadasya.
Of Utanapada, the father of Dhruva Maharaj.
Utanapada, the father of Dhruva Maharaj.
Dhruvasya.
Dhruvasya.
Of Dhruva Maharaj.
Of Dhruva Maharaj.
Api. Certainly.
Certainly.
Mahi Patehe.
Mahi Patehe.
Of the great king.
Of the great king.
Priyavratasya.
Priyavratasya.
Of King of Priyavracha.
Of Priyavracha.
In the family of Maharaj Dhruva.
In the family of Maharaj Dhruva.
Rajarshahe.
Rajarshahe.
Of great saintly kings.
Of great saintly kings.
Angasya.
Angasya.
Of the name Anga.
Of the name Anga.
Asmat.
Asmat.
My.
My.
Pituhu.
Pituhu.
Of my father.
Of my father.
Pituhu.
Pituhu.
Of the father.
Of the father.
Idrishanam.
Idrishanam.
Of such personalities.
Of such personalities.
Atta.
Also,
Anyesham, of others,
Ajasya,
of the supreme immortal,
Cha,
also,
Vavasya,
of the living entities,
Cha,
also, Praladasya, of Maharaj Pralad, Balahe, of Maharaj Bali,
Cha,
also, Api,
certainly,
Krityam,
acknowledged by them,
Asti,
there is,
Gadabhrita,
the supreme personality of Godhead who carries a club.
Srila Prabhupada's translation. Now, actually, before I read this translation, it starts with the word this. The particular translation starts with the word this, without any antecedent for the word this. So I think we have to go back to the previous verse to see what this is. Right? Okay. So in the previous verse, Maharaj Prithu said, I'm not going to read the whole, well, okay. My dear respectable ladies and gentlemen, according to the authoritative statements of Shastra, there must be a supreme authority who is able to award the respective benefits of our present activities. Otherwise, why should there be persons who are unusually beautiful and powerful, both in this life and in the life after death? So what Maharaj Prithu has just said is there has to be an authority. So there must be God. So that's the this. And what was his argument given that there must be a God? Awarding the results. And how can we see that? Because in this life, yes, we don't all have the same degree of power and beauty and so many other things. So his conclusion was, logically, because different people have different situations, somebody must be controlling that. Okay, so that's the this of this verse. Everybody got that?
Yeah.
Okay. So, this translation. This is confirmed not only by the evidence of the Vedas, but also by the personal behavior of such great personalities like Manu, Uttanapada, Dhruva, Priyavrata, and my grandfather Anga, as well as by many other great personalities and ordinary living entities, exemplified by Maharaj Prahlada and Bali, all of whom are theists, believing in the existence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead who carries a club. I like it on your board. You didn't have room for the whole translation, so you stuck the "who carries a club" on a little piece of paper stuck to the bottom of the board. When I first saw that, I'm like, huh? And then I realized it was part of the translation. Srila Prabhupada's purport. Narottama Das Thakur states that one has to ascertain the right path for his activities by following in the footsteps of great saintly persons and books of knowledge under the guidance of a spiritual master, Sadhu Shastra Guru Vakya. A saintly person is one who follows the Vedic injunctions, which are the orders of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The word guru refers to one who gives proper direction under the authority of the Vedic injunctions and according to the examples of the lives of great personalities. The best way to mold one's life is to follow in the footsteps of the authorized personalities like those mentioned herein by Prithu Maharaj, beginning with Swayambhuva Manu. The safest path in life is to follow such great personalities, especially those mentioned in the Srimad Bhagavatam. The Mahajanas or great personalities are Brahma, Lord Shiva, Narad Muni, Manu, the Kumaras, Prahlad Maharaj, Bali Maharaj, Yamaraj, Bhishma, Janaka, Sukadeva Goswami, and Kapila Muni. Okay, quick test. Who are the Mahajanas without looking? Sukadeva Goswami,
Brahma,
Shiva. Okay, good. So reading the translation again. This is confirmed not only by the evidence of the Vedas, but also by the personal behavior of great personalities like Manu, Uttanapada, Dhruva, Priyavrata, and my grandfather Anga, as well as by many other great personalities and ordinary living entities, exemplified by Maharaj Prahlada and Bali, all of whom are theists, believing in the existence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead who carries a club. So one of the distinguishing aspects of human life as opposed to animal life is we can ask, who am I? What am I doing here? And is there anybody in charge? The animals don't really have the capacity for asking that question. I mean, animals will sometimes wonder who's in charge as far as whether or not they're going to get in trouble for something. You know, so the animals will look around to see, okay, there's some food over there. Does that belong to a bigger, stronger animal who might take it from me? Am I going to get attacked? So an animal has some sense, you know, am I in the territory of another animal? Isn't it? They'll smell, you know, is there a bigger tiger or a bigger dog who owns this territory? And is this, you know, is this food being guarded by somebody else? So even they have some sense that there might be some more powerful authority than them. But animals are not capable of asking, what's going on, and has anybody made anything? They really can't ask that question. You know, as Prabhupada will often say, they're concerned simply with eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. Now, it's a fact that today in human society, many human beings are also engaged simply in eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. But they don't do much else. But even a very unconscious, one could say, human being has some idea of a philosophy of life, even if it's not articulated, even if they don't talk about it much. They have some idea as, you know, what's my purpose? And we all have a desire for meaning, isn't it? Everybody wants to feel, every human being, even a very
animal-like human being, has some desire for their life to have some kind of meaning. Even criminals want to feel, you know, I'm loyal to my criminal gang, I've been kind to my family. I mean, it's just ubiquitous among human society. I was nice to my dog. I did something. No human being wants to feel that their life is meaningless or that their actions are... It's one of the most devastating things to feel, is that my life doesn't have value and my life doesn't have meaning. But how in the world do we decide what has meaning if we don't know what is the purpose of life? Meaning is in relationship to something. It's not just... You can't define meaning and value in and of itself. It has to be in relationship to a purpose. And how can there be a purpose unless there's somebody who's created the world for some purpose? I mean, we can try to imagine our own purpose. You know, we have a purpose of love or justice or something like that. But that's not ultimately very satisfying. And so you find in human society, Prabhupada makes this point all the time, that there's always some kind of religion. That even in very simple societies, there's some sort of religion. You know, I don't know what I'm not sure what the proper politically correct term is for the, you know, indigenous people who lived a simple life. I don't know what do you call them? Tribal people. Well, here would be the Aborigines, but they're in every part of the world. In every part of the world, there were indigenous people who lived very simply, who didn't have a very sophisticated type of civilization. But everybody had some religion, whether it's a very sophisticated civilization or a very simple civilization. Everybody had some explanation as to who made things and what is the meaning of life and what is the purpose of life that created a gauge against which you could measure your own life. Now you might say, well, Mila, there's many atheists in the world. That's a fact, but atheists also have a philosophy of life. They have a philosophy of origin. You know, the atheists also explain the origin of the universe. And they explain some sort of purpose. You know, the people who believe that everything came from matter, from some, you know, exploding chunk, and who believe in neo-Darwinism, they say the purpose of life is survival of the fittest. That life is getting better and better and better and better because we're weeding out the unfit. So that's a kind of purpose and meaning in life, isn't it? Which is ironic because such people are talking about everything being the result of random chance. So if everything's a result of random chance, why should it keep getting better and better? But still they come up with some meaning. I was doing some reading recently from some scientist who said that actually cooperation is much more evident in society, even animal society, than is competition. And the idea that everything's just competitive, you know, may the best species win and may the best individual win and let everybody else die, that's not really the predominant feature. And he's an evolutionist, but he's saying the predominant feature is really cooperation. So my point is that every human being is looking for some kind of meaning of life and some kind of origin of life. So we have several ways to understand what is the meaning in the origin of life. So one way is by using logic and reason, by using our senses and logic. And Prithu Maharaj is using that in the previous verse. He says, we see that things externally are uneven. I mean, if we look around this room, I think everybody here is attractive, but some people we could say objectively are more attractive than others. Right? I mean, my husband used to tell me, you're the most beautiful woman in the world, and I always felt that that wasn't an objective statement. You know, so what we may think like that, we may think, you know, my wife, my husband is the, or my child, you know, someone has, oh, this is the cutest baby in the world, and you're thinking, maybe. But on an objective platform, there are some people that are more attractive than others. Yes? There are people that are pretty much universally understood to be attractive, and people who are universally understood to be unattractive. And some people are smarter than others. There's, you know, you could say our measures of intelligence are not entirely objective, but they're somewhat objective. Some people are richer than others. Well, that's a pretty objective measurement. Some people are physically stronger than others. That's kind of an objective measurement. Some people are healthier than others. Some people have a happier family situation than others. Yes, it's not even. And so when you look at things that are not even, you could come to several logical conclusions. One is that there's no real purpose. Everything is just kind of whimsical and random, which is kind of depressing, isn't it? If you look around and you say, well, you know, this person is born ugly and crippled and poor to a family of criminals who abuses him. And this person is born beautiful and intelligent and healthy in a wealthy family that gives them all opportunity, and that's just random. Well, that's really, really depressing. Because no amount of political manipulations and social justice is ever going to make absolute full equality for everybody in terms of opportunity. It is not going to happen. Even if we perfected genetic engineering, we still wouldn't be able to make it happen. It's never happened. You know, when I was in graduate school, the big theme was social justice, social justice. Give everyone equal opportunity. You know, and you can level the playing field somewhat, but can you ever do it 100%? No. So that's very depressing if we say it's all random chance. And the other logical conclusion is someone's running the show. Just like in any kind of business, some people get a higher position and a higher salary than others. Supposedly because they're more qualified. May not always be the case. But that's the idea. The idea as to why some students get an A and some students get a C is that, well, some students worked harder. Again, that's not absolutely true, but that's the concept. That the teacher is giving different grades, the employer is giving different facility because people are behaving differently. The government pays for one person's university tuition and pays for another person's prison sentence. And again, that's not absolutely done properly by human beings. But the concept is there that the person who goes to the university and the person who went to the prison, they're deserving of different outcomes. And therefore, they got different outcomes. If you looked at that and just said, well, that's just random. It's just sort of random that some people are in prison and other people are in university and the government's paying for both of them. Then how could you even function? And how would we be able to function at all if we felt that these things were random? It would be very depressing. So this is one of Prithu Maharaj's logical arguments for the fact that there must be a God. Now here we are in the fourth canto. Later on in the sixth canto, the Yamadutas give a logical argument, which is very similar, as to why there must be one God and not many. Does anyone know that argument of the Yamadutas? It's very similar to this argument. Yes?
There's many controllers and there's no real authority.
There's no real authority, and then what would happen?
Like there would be no law. Because everybody would have different law.
Everybody would have different law.
Yes,
and different judgment. And the Yamadutas said that if there were many competing gods, then some people would be both punished and rewarded for the same thing. I mean, we see this in our ordinary life. A person does a particular action, and some people think it's a very good action, and other people think that same action is a very bad action. Isn't that a fact? Yes? Some politician makes some decision, passes some law, and some people are celebrating, this is the best law ever, and other people are saying, this is the worst law ever. So if you have many equal gods, some gods will say, well, this person did a great thing and should be rewarded. Another person will say, no, this person did a terrible thing and should be punished. So the Yamadutta said, you can't have many gods. There has to be one overarching authority. Logically speaking,
So those are some logical arguments for the existence of a controller and the existence of the supreme controller. So there may be many minor controllers. We admit that there's many subordinate controllers, but one overarching controller who has the ultimate decision. Any other logical arguments for the existence of God? Just logic. Forget about scripture, forget about anything, just our everyday experience, our senses and mind with logic. Some other arguments. Huh?
The sun goes up and down.
The sun goes up and down. There's some kind of order. And it goes up and down at very specific times. I have a little app on my phone. Wherever I go in the world, it can tell me when the sun is rising, when is it noon, when is the sun set, when is the moon rising, when does the moon set. And it can tell me this 100 years in advance, theoretically, or 1,000 years in advance, or 1,000 years behind. Yes? Like Sariputta in some of his books, one of our devotee scientists. So he was able to do astronomical calculations for thousands of years in the past. Could you do that for airplanes? Could you give an exact time that all the planes are going to take off and land? And could you predict that 10 years into the future? Could you even predict that for today? And how much intelligence has to go into airplanes? Unbelievable how many thousands of people, tens of thousands maybe, are involved with designing airplanes and building them and checking on them and maintaining them and flying them and controlling them, the air traffic controllers. It's a huge, huge job that involves so many people, and I'm sure that all of those people are intelligent people. They're intelligent human beings. None of them are, you know, orangutans or 2-year-old children. So we have the planets, which we can say, this is where this planet's going to be, and this is where this planet's going to be. We can make predictions thousands of years in the past and thousands of years into the future that are accurate predictions. So, okay, some more logical evidence for the existence of God. Yes?
Just that the human intelligence, for example, is so superior, like you said, designing big jets and skyscrapers. It's just so intricate, and even the traffic lights and all that sort of thing. So to say that this is originated from monkeys and a big bang is not very...
Yes, okay, so the complexity. So we have an argument from order and an argument for complexity. So to say that the complexity of human intelligence has just arisen from some chance combination of matter. Frankly, even one single cell, the most simple form of life, is unbelievably complex and is not even fully understood by the greatest human minds. So the greatest human minds, the greatest human scientists have not fully understood the working of one of the simplest single cell organisms. They're still finding out new information about how it works. So the degree of complexity, we don't find that complexity comes about by chance interactions of matter. Even quite simple things like these mats that most of you are sitting on, these are very, very simple things. None of these mats is anywhere near the complexity of a single cell. Of a single living cell. And yet we can immediately understand that it must have been made by somebody with intelligence. Right? Even a mat like that could not have been made by an orangutan or a chimpanzee. Right? It had to be made by some intelligent human being. All right? So we have order, we have complexity. Anything else? Dependability. Any other logical arguments for the existence of God? Yes.
If we took all the vulture apes, then why didn't other species that are still in the world today evolve along the same path?
Yes, okay. So that's an argument about a particular theory of evolution, that why did it go this particular way? If that's true, we would expect to see a different phenomenon than we're actually seeing. Very nice. Yes.
that different laws in place?
There are laws. Srila Prabhupada makes this argument quite a lot, that scientists talk about laws of nature, laws of mathematics. Now, as soon as you say there's a law, there must be a lawmaker. There wouldn't be a law without a lawmaker. The implication is already there. You know, if you go to a foreign country, you don't see, you may not even know who the head of that country is. But how do you know there's a government? You know there's a government because there's laws. You come to the country and there's some immigration officer, and there's lines on the road, and there's traffic lights, and there's police officers. So even if you don't know what kind of government it is, you don't know if it's a democracy or if it's a theocracy. I have no idea what kind of government it is. You don't know who the name of the person is, nothing at all. But you still know there must be a government. There must be someone who's making a rule. I mean, even you look in this temple room, and the male human beings are sitting here, and the female human beings are sitting there, except for you.
I'm sorry.
That's fine. I didn't actually mean to poke fun at you. But that means somebody must have made a rule that this is where people sit. Some temples I go to, it's a very complicated rule. You ever been in those temples? Where the women are on this side for Mangal Arti, and then they're on this side for Tulsi Puja, and then you greet the deities, and the ladies are here, and then during Guru Puja they go over here, and then for the next kirtan they kind of go over. You ever been in one of those temples? Right? I've been in a number of them, where you're just like, okay, where's everybody else walking to? Which part of the... And somebody made this rule about where people are supposed to go. And you see where people go, and you understand there's some kind of rule. Yes? Does this make sense? So we look at the world, we see there must be some kind of lawmaker, that there's universal law, some other logical... Yes?
There has to be a person in charge to allot each person's deserts.
Well, that was the first argument that Prithu made in the previous verse. That is his argument. So you've echoed Prithu's argument. Yes?
Every creation has got a creator.
Every creation has a creator. So every creation that we know about has a creator. Whether it's as simple as the mat we're sitting on, or whether it's as complex as the paintings on the wall, the carvings on the wall. When we are familiar, when we know the situation, there is some creator. All right, but we have a limit as to what we can understand through logic and reason. So through logic and reason, I know there must be a creator. Like, I see these paintings on the wall. I know somebody painted them. I see the mats, and I know somebody made them. I know that, and I know it must be a human, and I know it must be an intelligent human. I see that there's some sort of rule that everybody's following, that I understand somebody must have made the rule. And by logic and reason, I can understand there must be one supreme creator and maker of rule. Okay, and that's, how much more can I understand? So now I'm going to ask, what can I understand about the nature of that creator? Just through logic and reason. Putting aside Shastra, putting aside guru, saintly persons, just by looking around at life, what can I understand about the nature of that creator? Yes.
Arguably, there's some fairness.
There's some fairness. Okay, we do see some natural action and reaction. Although certain things do seem unfair. Okay?
The intelligence of such a person must be
vast.
Way beyond any
okay. So we've got... This person seems like must be a just person. We're not quite sure about that. That's the only good atheistic argument, is that we're not quite sure if God is just. But it seems that God is just and certainly intelligent. What else can we tell about the nature of God? Yes?
It's merciful in the sense that for every need, there is a substitution.
Oh, I really like that. I don't think I've ever heard anyone express that way. That God, we can see God is merciful because for every need there's a way of fulfilling it. Yes?
He must have all opulences that we can see in this world. He must have all of them.
Ah, so as he's the creator of all the opulence in this world, he must own all these opulences. So he must be a very opulent person, yes.
He must not
only be intelligent, but actually know everything. You'd have to know a lot of things. Yes.
Above
the laws. Yes, the lawmaker is generally above the law. Some more.
Well, you can know there's a lot you don't know.
You can know that there's a lot you don't know. Okay, but what more can we know? There's some more things we can know. We haven't gotten to that yet. You're on my next area. You've jumped to the last area. Yes?
What about omnipresence?
Like? Being everywhere. Well, it's likely, at least. I don't know if we can know that for sure by logic, but it's certainly likely. Yes?
Must know us pretty well.
Must know us pretty well, yeah. Would you say that the creator is pretty efficient? Is there some efficiency going on here? Isn't everything in a cycle? You know, we have our recycling plants. But doesn't nature recycle everything? Like, everything? We have the water cycle. We all learned about this in school, right? It rains, and then the water percolates through the ground. It gets purified, and it gets evaporated and rains again. He's reusing the same water over and over again. And there's always enough water. And everything that dies becomes food for the next life. Right? All the dead bodies, all the waste products, right? Urine and feces are fertilizer for food. Yes?
Yes.
So the creator is very efficient. He doesn't waste anything. And everything that's bad can be used for a good purpose. The stinky, toxic, decaying things are all the basis for life and health. What about, does the creator like variety? A lot of variety. Yeah? Have any potted plants. We have tulsi, of course. So if you look at any plant, are any two leaves the same? On the same plant, are any two leaves exactly the same? Any two flowers exactly the same on the same plant? What about two different plants of the same species? Each leaf is a little different, each flower is a little different. Then what about all the species? I read once this Muslim talking about the creator, and he was saying that evolution cannot explain, and this is one of the things that evolutionists grapple with, they cannot explain a lot of the beauty in the world and a lot of the variety in the world simply in terms of fitness for survival. In fact, some of the beauty in the world actually makes the entities less fit for survival, like a peacock's tail is a hindrance to the peacock's survival. So we see that there's a lot of beauty in the world, and even the ugliness actually is a foundation for beauty, which is interesting. And there's a tremendous amount of variety. Even though we're only in these bodies for a short time, this body is unique. There'll never be another body exactly like this one, which is why even if a body's been dead for thousands of years, it can be identified as belonging to a completely unique individual. Right? The bones, the dental records. Oh, it belonged to this person. You'd think with all the human beings who've been born on this planet that God would run out of, dental configurations and fingerprints and he'd have to repeat them. But there is no repeating of them. And each snowflake is different. I don't think it snows here. Does it ever snow here? Very rarely. So, and have all of you seen snow? I always wonder about giving the snow example. So each snowflake is unique. Now that always surprises me, because who would care? I mean, who looks at every snowflake? So whoever the creator is must really, really like variety. Every grain of sand, you can look this up later. This is your homework, home fun assignment. So do a search. Magnified grains of sand. Each one is beautiful. You know, you just walk down to the beach here, it's just, oh, it's all the same. It's not. You look at them under a microscope, they're each different colors and different shapes. And each one is unique. Each grain of sand unique. Each snowflake unique. Each fingerprint unique. Each leaf on the same tree unique. So we can certainly say that the Creator really likes variety. More than we do. You know, we're happy to have a factory that makes every phone the same so you can buy interchangeable parts, you know. I mean, the doctors would like that if we had fully interchangeable parts. It would make organ transplants a lot simpler. You know, but God's a variety person and a beauty person. All right, but we do reach a limit that which we say, you know, I can know so much about the Creator, but not more than that. So Preacher Marsh is telling us two things here. First of all, he's telling us we should believe there's a Creator because very great personalities believe there's a Creator. So he gave an argument from logic in the previous verse. We should believe there's a Creator because we see disparities which must be awarded by somebody according to some kind of criteria. And here he's saying we should believe it because great personalities believe it. Now, this argument is actually very salient. There's a lot of psychological research that shows that if people have a very strong opinion, they will not change their opinion when presented with contradictory facts. And if you didn't know that, please keep this in mind. We generally try to convince other people that they're wrong by presenting them with opposing facts. According to psychological research, such an approach does not work. In fact, such an approach tends to solidify the person stronger in their existing belief. I know that seems contrary to logic, but evidently we also work that way. It's not just all the other stupid people out there. It's not that I am convinced by contrary facts, but you know, all the other fools are not. But the more contrary facts that we hear, the more we tend to become solidified in our existing opinion. Weird, huh? I have a book waiting for me to read about all the predictable ways in which human beings are irrational. I haven't read it yet. I have it. So what is it that convinces people to change their mind? Useful information to know, right? Two things. Stories rather than facts, and the opinion of someone they respect. Now, I had a good friend who, with her first baby, was planning to have a birth with the doctor that she'd seen before she got pregnant, even though that doctor only dealt with high-risk pregnancies. So myself and her husband were trying to convince her, since you don't have any particular problem, it's really not a good idea to have your baby with a doctor who deals with high-risk pregnancies. He's likely to do some sort of intervention that you wouldn't really need. And there was nothing myself or her husband or anyone else could say that would convince her. And then she went to some childbirth classes, and the person teaching the childbirth classes was encouraging the ladies there to see doctors who dealt with low-risk pregnancies. And when she heard that from the authority, then she immediately accepted. So this is often the way we work. If we hear something from somebody we respect as an authority, then we'll change our mind. Or if we hear stories. Those two things, stories which deal with us emotionally and bypass our false ego, convince us, as do people we respect. So here, Preacher Marsh is saying, these are respectable people. Who are the people he mentioned? Anybody remember? Without looking up at the Sanskrit on the board. Manu, Dhruva, without looking at the board, Priyavata. Prahlad. Now, by the way, a lot of Anga, a number of these people were persons that the persons to whom he was speaking probably knew. Like, I only know about Prahlad from a book. But these people, you know, they certainly knew Anga, his grandfather, his father's father. And they probably knew some of these other personalities directly. Or they knew of them more as contemporaries. Whereas for myself, it's like, well, I don't really know these people. I mean, maybe some of you have met Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva, but I don't usually run into them in my normal everyday life. So to have recourse to authority. I mean, frankly, one of the reasons I joined ISKCON was because George Harrison chanted Hare Krishna. I'm very serious. You know, I was in secondary school, I was in high school, and he produced that song, My Sweet Lord, and we were going around singing this, and he's chanting Hare Krishna at the end of the song. And I thought, well, if George Harrison's into Hare Krishna, it must be good. This is very common. And in fact, Krishna says this. What's that verse? Yad yad acharati shrestas. Whatever the authorities do, we tend to follow. You know, and this is true for ridiculous things, like some celebrity wears a certain kind of t-shirt and then everybody wears the t-shirt. Or a celebrity doesn't wear a t-shirt. You know, so everybody takes off their t-shirts. This is... Prabhupada talked about a silent film he saw when he was young. I think it was with Charlie Chaplin, where his tuxedo ripped, and so he went into the men's room and ripped it all the way. And then he went back on the dance floor and was dancing, and everybody saw him, and they thought, oh, that must be the latest fashion, and they ripped their tuxedos to match. This is actually what happens. You know, if you want to make a change in society, that's one way that you do it. You get very prominent authorities to make that change. You know, like there are places in the world where people still don't regularly wear seatbelts in cars. Like when you're in India, people, they take the seatbelts in the back and they put them under the seat so you can't even put them on if you want to. You know, you have to practically take the car apart to get to the seatbelts. And the driver will put on, you know, we're driving from Vrindavan to Delhi, and when we hit the border of Delhi, the driver puts a seatbelt on because then he knows it's going to be checked and fined. So how is it in America that pretty much everybody puts on their seatbelts? Do you know how that happened? People went to those who make movies and television shows and says, show all the actors putting on their seatbelts. Or you may be familiar with the concept of designated driver. Have you heard about that? So if a group of people go out to drink alcohol and somebody has to drive back, to prevent people driving while they're intoxicated, they say, well, have a designated driver. This person doesn't drink any alcohol, and so they can drive everybody back. And the way that that concept was popularized, the person who came up with this concept went to the movie producers and the television producers and said, will you give me 3 seconds of your show that would save hundreds of thousands of lives? They said, sure. They said, just add the word designated driver to any scene where people are drinking out of their home. And by doing that, it became part of the conversation. Oh, the movie stars have a designated driver. We should too. This is how it works. You know, so when you have very popular, very rich, very, you know, whatever, famous, beautiful, talented people who are propounding something, then other people will follow. So Prithu Maharaj is giving this argument. These are very intelligent people. These are very learned people. These are people of great character and morality. And they believe in God, so you should too. Then he gives also another very interesting fact, which is on your little piece of paper that's hanging off of the board here. And what does that little piece of paper say? Who carries a club? So he's saying here that these great personalities, not only do they believe in God, but they know something about him. Now, there's no way I could look at nature and logic and know that God carries a club. I wouldn't know that. I know he likes variety. I know he likes beauty. I know he's efficient. I know he's intelligent. I know he's merciful. But I wouldn't know that he carries a club. I certainly wouldn't know that he plays a flute. I'm sure he plays other things too. I'm sure he can play all instruments. But I wouldn't know that. I wouldn't know that his original color is like a dark rain cloud. I wouldn't know that he likes to take care of cows and goats and buffaloes, by the way, too. And there's no way I can know that by looking at nature and just using logic. So here with this little statement at the end, Gadabrita, which you can't see on the board because it's at the end of text 29 and only 28 is on the board. By that little statement, Pritchard Maharaj is saying, you know, these people not only know there's a God, they know something about him. So this goes from, I know an artist painted this picture, to, I know something about the artist. I know the name of the artist. I know what the artist likes to eat. So that's a different level of knowing. Now, if we really want to know the meaning and the purpose of life, we would have to go beyond just there is a God and to knowing who is that God and what did he make this world for? Because only when we know what he made this world for would we be able to evaluate our own actions, our own thoughts, our own desires, and compare that to his purpose to see if they align. And we can only know what he made the world for when we know something about him personally. So every bona fide religion in the world teaches something about what God is like personally and something about his purpose. But we are very, very fortunate that the Srimad Bhagavatam is giving us in-depth knowledge. I mean, and the unfortunate thing is that in many religions, they even discount their own accounts of the nature of God. Right? I was in a couple days ago in Penang, Malaysia. Bhakti Chaitanya Maharaj was giving class, and he was talking about how Brahma saw Krishna and heard directly from Krishna. He was saying how the Bhagavatam says that Lord Vishnu came and shook Brahma's hand and congratulated him. There's actually a very similar statement in Exodus about Moses, that he saw God face to face like a friend speaks with another friend. But if you ask most biblical scholars, does God have a face? They'll say no. I said, but it says it right there in Exodus. Oh, that's just poetry. Or God wrote on the tablets of stone the Ten Commandments with his finger. Oh, so God must have a finger. Oh, well, that's just metaphor. Or, you know, the Song of Solomon, he has eyes like the eyes of a dove. He has a fragrance like frankincense and myrrh. Actually, the description in the Song of Solomon and the description of Sankarsana as seen by Chitraketu are almost identical. But again, if you ask them, what's the meaning of the Song of Solomon? Oh, it's some metaphorical poetry about... It's not really about the form of God. So that's most unfortunate. But we have this, here is just a little hint in this verse. Oh, by the way, he carries a club. Just a little hint. So if you just heard this verse, you go, oh, really? Like, you know what he carries? Really? Have you met him? Do you know him? Does he carry something else? Does he do something else? That's like a little teaser. Yeah, a little teaser for us to be eager to hear more. So we have a great advantage in this Krishna consciousness movement. We have a huge advantage. Not that we should become proud of our advantage, but we have a great advantage, and we should take advantage of our advantage. First of all, to align our life with the actual purpose of Krishna. To do that, not just to know about it theoretically, I was just reading this very, very famous public speaker was speaking to a business organization, and he asked everybody, how many of you have read such and such book? First he asked, how many of you own such and such book? If you own it, stand up. And like 99% of the people stood up, some famous business book. How many of you have read it? Keep standing. Almost everybody kept standing. How many of you believe it's a great book and it's true and it would help your business? And almost everybody kept standing. All right, well, on page 38 of that book, it says you should do such and such every day. How many of you do that? And everybody sat down. And he said, how interesting that even when we've studied something and we believe it to be true, we may not put it into practice. If we said, how many of us believe here that the holy name is the same as God? Oh, I believe that. How many of us believe that if I really paid attention to the holy name with a proper attitude, that I would experience that he holds a club? I wouldn't just have to read about it in a book. Oh, I believe that. So how many of us really chant Japa with the proper attitude? So, you know, we should take advantage of what we have in the way we worship the deities, in the way we worship the holy name, in the way we worship Prasadam, in the way we worship the Bhagavatam, with everything. How do I deal with my Japa, with my Gayatri, with my study of the Shastra, with the worship of the deities, with my dealing with the other devotees, with the Prasadam? I mean, I have to say myself, sometimes I get very complacent. Oh, they're passing around the flower that they offered to Krishna. Yeah, yeah, okay, here's the flower. Okay, yeah, whatever. You know, am I really thinking, oh, Krishna, smell this flower? If I really thought like that, how excited I would be. I mean, sometimes among the simple village people in India, they're so excited about honoring the ghee lamp, you wonder if they're going to set the whole temple on fire. You know? It's like, calm down, calm down. But we should have some enthusiasm to take advantage of what we know and not leave it just on the theoretical platform. Oh yeah, I know that there's God, and look, he's there in the picture. And oh, he's got a big club in that picture. Whoa. Does he ever carry a club in that picture? It's the most prominent aspect of the whole picture. You know, and his club is a person. Kamodakai has a name, has a personality. All of the Lord's weapons have a personality. So we want to take advantage in two ways. First of all, if I want to have meaning and value in my life, which if I'm a human being, I do, then to find out how does Krishna define a meaningful, valuable life and align my life with that. And the ultimate meaning and value of my life is to align my desires with the personality of Godhead and to love the personality of Godhead by meditating on his personality and by falling in love with his personality, including the fact that he carries a club. So, questions, comments, additions, subtractions? Bless you. Yes?
Thank you very much, Namaste. I want to ask, did you have a specific reason that he mentioned exactly the club? Like, could have said so many things about Krishna, but he just mentioned that he emphasized that he carries a club.
I have no idea. And I didn't have time yesterday to look up the commentaries, which I usually do, so I don't know.
Well,
you know what I could do, because I have more time to prepare for tomorrow's class. I could look up for today's verse too and see if any of the acharyas say anything about that. Why he specifically mentioned. Yesterday was a little busy.
Yeah.
I just got the verse yesterday. I was a little busy yesterday.
Because I was thinking of preaching, it's like we usually tell people what
to call. We would usually say flute.
Like, yeah, we say something. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I take it as just a little teaser is what I take it. He's telling everybody there's a God because different people get different rewards and punishments. There's a God because all these great personalities that you respect that are highly qualified say there is. Oh, and by the way, he carries a club. So I take it as a little like, because good teachers do that, by the way. It's one of the elements of good teaching. They don't tell you everything. And they give you some little teaser for the next installment. Yes?
You know, you're mentioning about how logically you can prove the existence of God and how you can logically come to some amount of conclusion as to what God would have.
Yes.
But then you look at all these big logicians in the society and they don't quite come to that conclusion, although they're very good.
Very good point. So how is it, now you're looking at the reverse, you can say, well, wait a minute, there's a lot of intelligent leaders in society who don't accept the existence of God. And they're also using logic. So these same arguments of logic and authority could also be used to substantiate atheism. Yes? Now, do the logical, intelligent people who are atheists, do they say there's no cause? Or do they give a cause? They give a cause. Do they give a cause that is fully explainable, or do they give a cause that is somewhat supernatural? Supernatural.
Unintelligible.
Unintelligible, supernatural. The cause they give, is it something we see in our everyday life? Do we see this singularity of infinitely small, infinitely dense singularity existing beyond space and time that causelessly explodes? But do we see anything that's infinitely small, infinitely dense, that causelessly explodes and in that explosion creates order and variety and ultimately life?
In their brain.
To the level of human, you know, oak trees, apple trees, all the variety. Is this something that any of us experience? So is their explanation supernatural?
Yes.
Yes. Can their explanation be absolutely proved? They can have evidence of it, just like we can have evidence for God. Can we prove the existence of God? No. No, we cannot. The only one way to prove the existence of God, and that's on an individual level when you meet him. That's all. Pratyaksha avagamam dharma. That's the only way that an individual gets proof of the existence of God. Otherwise, we can provide ample evidence. So they can they prove their origin story or any of the varieties of atheistic origin stories? Can any of those be proved? No, they have some evidence. So are they or are they not propounding something based also on faith and authority? Yes. So they have some logical arguments. There's only one really strong logical argument for atheism, actually. What's the only strong logical argument for atheism?
That things aren't fair.
That things aren't fair. That they're suffering. That's the only strong logical argument in favor of atheism. You know, that it appears that nice people suffer and bad people enjoy. And it appears that absolutely terrible things happen to innocents. You know, so that's their only strong argument for atheism. And frankly, very few religious systems answer that argument, in my opinion, adequately. Now, even for us, in the Bhagavatam, Dharma the Bull gives 7 different reasons for suffering. One of them is that it's inexplicable. But I would say that overall, the way we explain apparent unfairness and suffering makes a whole lot of sense. I mean, you do have to accept the idea of reincarnation. You have to accept that this life is not everything. Is there empiric evidence for reincarnation? Is there empirical evidence for reincarnation?
Devotees.
Yes. No, there's many, many people who spontaneously remember past lives. And many of those people who spontaneously remember past lives, their memories can be verified objectively. Now, there are some things that we can't fully explain. because there's some things we just can't fully understand with the human brain. So there are, we don't claim in the Krishna consciousness movement that we can adequately, fully, absolutely explain everything to the satisfaction of a human brain. But we can explain pretty much everything. And, you know, these atheistic perspectives have a huge amount of things they can't explain. I mean, the main things that the atheistic perspectives can't explain is anything beyond the gross body. They can't explain the mind. Is there a tremendous amount of empiric evidence for the existence of mind beyond the body? Tremendous. When I was talking to one atheist some years ago, his wife was interested in Krishna consciousness, and she wanted me to talk to her husband, who was an atheist. The only thing I talked about with him was out-of-body experiences. That's all I talked about. That was it. I mean, Prabhupada was once asked, how do you first preach to someone? The devotee said, you tell them there's a God. He said, no, first you tell them they're not this body. So I didn't even say that this man were souls. I was just talking about mind. I was just talking about subtle matter. And I said, there's thousands and thousands of very well-documented out-of-body experiences. I mean, really solid scientific documentation. Someone's in the surgery room, in the operating theater, and they leave their body, they're floating on the ceiling, and they can see the stickers on the tops of the lights that nobody in the room can see. They can give objective, verifiable information that they could only have gotten if they were out of their body. There's just no other rational explanation for it at all. And there's thousands and thousands and thousands of cases like this. What to speak of all the paranormal phenomena which governments study, by the way, so they can try to use it militarily. There was a time when the former Soviet Union was studying these things very openly. And there was a time in America at Duke University, there was a very open government-funded department to study paranormal. Now they pretend they're not studying it, but I'm sure they are. I mean, one, this is horrific, but there was one study done by the Soviets. Again, their purpose was to militarize the information, which was done in Vedic times too, by the way. They had subtle weapons for military use. That's not just a Kali Yuga thing. But they did this horrible experiment where they had this mother rabbit in the laboratory in Russia, and they took her babies down into a submarine that was encased in like lead, the chamber, and they killed the babies one by one. And every time they killed the babies, the mother rabbit had a change in heartbeat and respiration, even though she was thousands of miles away on land and the little babies were in the submarine. How can you explain that if we're just machines? So the problem with this, with an atheistic viewpoint, is there's a huge amount of empiric evidence that can't be explained. Tremendous amount, just of empiric, logical evidence that they cannot explain. And the origin story that they're telling is equally supernatural. So we have a far-out supernatural story of this humongous blue person with four arms breathing out bubbles of universes. That's a pretty far out story. And then he goes into the universe again as this gigantic blue four-arm person with a lotus coming out of his belly button and a four-headed person is on. I mean, that's a far out story. But it's not any more far out than there's an infinitely small, infinitely dense lump of matter beyond space and time that explodes and turns into oak trees and orangutans. You know, one story isn't any more far out or supernatural than the other. Both are beyond perception, both are beyond logic, both are beyond ordinary science. So if they want to present that, well, we're the more logical, we're the more scientific, we'd say, I don't really think so. And what about all the things you can't explain that we can? You know, there. I don't know of any origin story that isn't supernatural. I don't have any society that has an origin story that's completely within the realm of our ordinary experience. So, sure, Matasmati Jnanam Apohanam Cha. Krishna can give you the intelligence to deny his existence. I saw a really, really, really funny thing the other day. It was this very famous actor. Really, really famous actor. And he was telling the story of how he was getting his car repaired. And one of the mechanics said to him, "You look just like that actor." And he said, "Well, actually, I am that actor." He said, "No way. No way. Forget it. I don't believe you. You're lying. But boy, do you look like him." And this actor was saying that the more he tried to prove that he actually was the person, the more the person was adamant that he... Remember I told you about contradictory facts? The more the person was adamant that he was lying. So we have that capacity. This has happened to me in my own life. People have come to me and said, "Urmila, you did this and this." I'm like, "I didn't." "Well, I know you did." I'm glad you know that I did something that I didn't do, you know. Like, I wasn't even there. You want to look at my passport stamps? You know, I wasn't even in that part of the world. "Oh, you're just making it up." Okay, Hare Krishna. So, you know, there's people that no matter what facts they're confronted with, the guy was showing his driver's license even. Yeah. I mean, he was there getting his vehicle repaired. He had his driver's license with him. That no matter what facts you present, have you ever had this where someone accused you of something or said you did something and it didn't matter what you said? It just didn't matter. It didn't matter what evidence you provided, it didn't matter what you said. They're like, "Or that's how you feel?" That's another interesting one. You know, "I know you feel like that, but I don't." I know you do. You know, "You're just in denial." That's a cute one. "You're just in denial." So if I say I did it, then I'm guilty. If I say I didn't do it, then I'm in denial. You can't win. So people are like that with God too. You know, here's evidence, and they go, "No, I don't believe it." Frankly, he could show up right in front of them and they wouldn't believe it. Like Krishna showed up right in front of Duryodhana and displayed his universal form. And Duryodhana's like, "I don't believe it." So, you know, that possibility is always there. Don't think, "Well, if God showed up in front of me, then I would have full faith." Well, not necessarily. Are we supposed to end now on Urdhva? Is this our ending time? Huh?
Let's have breakfast.
Thank you very much. Yeah.